Well, good morning, everybody. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Wednesday, the 8th of July. It's very nice to have you here. You know, if it weren't you, it just wouldn't be the same to have all of you here and soaking all of this up like a big sponge. It wouldn't be the same. The fact that you're here and listening and are such a part of our program is very, very important to us, and we thank you very, very much. While I am thanking people, let me thank Ray Graff for filling in for the last few days. I took a few days off for what I have been referring to as paternity leave because I got a puppy. I got an eight-week-old English Yellow Lab puppy. So I took a couple days off to bond and to make sure my wife would let me keep it. So it's great to be back, and thank you all, and especially Ray, for doing such a great job filling in. Let me introduce everybody to you. We'll get started. A reminder, you can always join our program panel. It's panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Alan Chartok is on the line. Hello, sir. How are you?
Hello, and welcome back, Joe. It's always great when you're here. And as you quite properly put it, Ray did a magnificent job in your absence. We're so lucky to have both of you.
Well, thank you. He's the best, and I so appreciate it. Let's see. We also have Times Union columnist Chris Churchill with us. Good morning, Chris. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. Congrats on that puppy. Thank you. That's an exciting time when you have a new puppy in the house.
I know. I feel like the newborn, like the father of a newborn. Like I walked out today. I grabbed my wife's phone. I have like two different colored socks on. It's just, it's not cool, but it's okay.
No sleep at night.
Well, I'm okay on the sleep part. The puppy's being very good, but still, I'm a wreck still. SUNY New Paltz communications professor and former New York State Senator Terry Gibson is with us. Good morning, Terry. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. Welcome back. And yeah, congratulations on that puppy.
Oh, thank
you. That's got to be a great time.
Oh, it's very fun. Oh, they're so cute. Judy Patrick is here, Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association. Judy doesn't know this yet, but because she runs around our neighborhood all the time, I want her just to come pick up the puppy and take it for a run.
You know, so I have a couple of eight-week-old kittens that I here at my house that I have just received, and they are running back and forth, so you may hear them. They sound like elephants, even though they probably weigh half a pound each.
Well, that sounds cute. We'll have to get those kids together. That'd be very fun. All right, let's get started, and we'll talk about what's going on in the world. Very nice to get back and find out what's happening. And then I think to myself, oh, God, we get to talk about this stuff. But here we go. We'll begin with the president on the reopening of schools. The president, as the New York Times puts it, is leaning on schools to reopen as virus continued its spread. President Trump demanded on Tuesday that schools reopen physically in the fall, pressing his drive to get the country moving again, even as the coronavirus pandemic surged through much of the United States and threatened to overwhelm some healthcare facilities. In a day-long series of conference calls and public events at the White House, the president, Education Secretary Betsy DeVos, and other senior officials opened a concerted campaign to lean on governors, mayors, and others to resume classes in person months after more than 50 million children were abruptly ejected from school buildings in March. Mr. Trump and his administration argued that the social, psychological, and educational costs of keeping children at home any longer would be worse than the virus itself. But they offered no concrete proposals or new financial assistance to states and localities struggling to restructure academic settings, staffs, and programs that were never intended to keep children 6 feet apart or cope with the requirements of combating a virus that has killed more than 130,000 Americans. Meanwhile, just another story that is somewhat related, which is that the president is looking at the visa rules. International students will now be required to take at least one in-person class to keep their visas at a time when many universities are prioritizing online instruction. Many think that this is a way of forcing those colleges also to open their doors this fall. So with those two stories, we go to Alan first. Good morning.
Well, good morning again, Joe. Look, there's no secret here. Trump wants to open the economy. He thinks it's the only way, pardon me, he thinks it's the only way he can win right now. And that looks dubious, but that's what he thinks. You can't have, unless you have custodial child care, unless you have, you know, teachers taking care of kids and at great personal risk to themselves, by the way. And I saw the head of the National Teachers Association on the air this morning, and you know you can't have them very close together. You've got to set up alternative classrooms and all the rest. So she's in. That's what she said, and I think that the whole idea here is if you don't have teachers and you don't have classrooms, then people can't go back to work. And for him, going back to work at all costs, no matter how many deaths there are, is what this is all about. So it's usual Trump nonsense. Does he care about anybody but himself? No.
Judy Patrick.
Well, thankfully, Donald Trump is not in charge of education. Neither is Betsy DeVos. He has no hand in this matter at all. So these are local decisions, state and local decisions. What would be helpful if the Centers for Disease Control came up with some useful guidelines for schools about how they should proceed. You know, we want to get the kids back in school, but we want to do it safely. The real question is how you're going to do it. I have watched, you know, with concern as, you know, poor children haven't been able to access instruction online. But let's not forget that if you get the kids back in school, there are a lot of special needs children that are going to have a hard time wearing a mask all the time. Or, you know, there are certain realities of dealing with children that we have to face. It's true that, you know, they don't have as severe an illness if they contract this virus, but there are a lot of teachers. I read somewhere that a third of America's teachers are over the age of 50, and even those under 50, many are facing severe health problems. So it's not just the kids you have to worry about their health. It's the teachers, it's the aides, it's the bus drivers, the cafeteria attendants. You know, we're waiting for Governor Cuomo to make a decision on New York schools. I think the state education department is working on it. But again, if Donald Trump is going to start trying to muscle this thing, at least come up with some good advice for us from the Centers for Disease Control.
Chris Churchill.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, he does. It's long been a Republican mantra that schools should be under local control, which I agree with, actually. And, you know, what that means is that Trump really has no authority in this area. He can, you know, stamp his feet all he wants, but it's not going to make a difference if governors don't want to go along.
Yeah, but when the president, president of the United States speaks, it has a certain amount of moral suasion, and there's always this question as to whether or not people will listen to him because he is the president. So it's not as if he's. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I think that's normally the case. But if you look at polling, this is people do not trust Donald Trump on the virus. This is one of the areas where he's really, really polling weakly. And I think people will see through this. I mean, this is pretty clearly about the economy and not about the safety of children and teachers.
Right.
You know, I do think there are probably ways that schools could open safely, at least in some parts of the country. But it's going to take an enormous amount of planning. And of course, there's been no help on that end from the federal government. You know,
no. Joe, we got a letter from Matt in Robbinsville, New Jersey, who says, "So, Mr. President, send Barron to the D.C. public schools in September, and if you're worried about him bringing the virus home, just have someone else take the test for him. Problem solved." And as you know, And as you probably know, in her new book, his niece is saying, you know, there was hanky-panky in his test taking.
And his SAT taking, yes. Terry Gibson.
Yes, well, you know, as an educator that's in the classroom pretty much every day, even now, although it's online, of course, at the moment, this is very disturbing. It's very upsetting. I'm following very closely the two universities that I work for and the efforts they're going through to try to figure out a way to offer a quality educational experience with the virus in place, and they're working very hard, just like every other public school and private school and college university across the country. administrators and educators are spending their entire summer trying to figure out how to do this. So for the president to come in the middle of all this, actually extremely late when many schools have already put plans in place, it is so infuriating and frustrating and unhelpful. And I think that, you know, the best that he can get out of this is just creating another political divide. Now it's mask. We don't have to wear a mask because the president says so. Now it's, you know, we should all have to go to school and expose ourselves to the virus because the president says so. So he's creating political division. But it's also ironic that a president who ran on a platform of trying to decrease the size of government, he actually ran against standardized testing, the Common Core, all of these big government programs he ran against. All of a sudden now he comes in and he wants to be the dictator that controls everything in education. And so it's laughable. And I also think that he's relatively powerless in being able to do anything about this. And one thing I do know is that the education industry, and it is an industry, when you combine both the public and private colleges and universities and K-12, they're very organized, extremely organized. They have very well-funded, very powerful advocacy programs. And I think they are going to severely regret this decision.
Alan, do you think that people act differently? You know, I'm not a parent. I think everyone else on the panel is. But it's different if you're saying, okay, well, I'm not going to wear a mask or I'm not going to do this. And then it's different than saying that, than saying, oh, by the way, I want to put your kid into this situation where they're going to be with a lot of other children and going to be sharing a bathroom and doing all that other stuff.
And they'll be bringing potentially the disease home.
Exactly.
So you make a very good point. I think, you know, the one thing you got to remember about this president is I don't think he gives a damn about whether or not his policy objective, like getting the schools started again, mean anything other than, you know, helping to open up business, which, again, at any cost, he's doing. I mean, we just had expert testimony saying that if everybody in America wore a mask, 60% of what we are now facing wouldn't be there, and he doesn't care about that. He doesn't care about that either. But I think the point is well taken that the thing we have to remember is he doesn't really care. He wants to throw this stuff out there. And much of his policy agenda never gets met, and nor does he want it to.
Chris?
Well, I just think he's just so wildly inconsistent. I mean, we've said before here that if he really wants to get the economy open, if that's really his number one priority, then mask wearing has to be accompany that. I mean, they go hand in hand. It just, you know, that's the key thing to stop the spread of the virus and to be able to reopen businesses. But when you encourage people not to wear masks, he's kind of shooting himself on the foot, or in the foot, sorry.
We also have to keep in mind that this isn't policy. When you just gather a bunch of people together in a room with no notice and make these ridiculous demands without any funding behind it, without any real direction behind it, without any real helpful guidance behind it, it's not policy. It's just a three-year-old jumping up and down and saying, do it this way or I'm going to cry.
How do you think? Go ahead, Judy.
Well, we can't. I mean, we also have to remember that every school district, at least here in New York State, if they're not laying off teachers, they're not filling positions because they're under severe financial stress because of the virus-related revenue shortfalls. So, and if anything, they're going to need more teachers because they're going to have smaller classes, and so they're going to need more. They're going to need to spend money to make physical improvements to the facilities. But and Congress is doing nothing to give relief to the school districts, and the president isn't saying anything about that at all, and that is one thing they could really do to help.
When you think about how schools are going to react, and because they have to make these decisions in New York State, the governor is putting together plans. He's asking the schools to put together plans, submit it to them, they will consider it and make a decision. Then is, as all of you, I think, have pointed out, there isn't a lot of teeth behind this. So it really is up to these governors and to decide what they do and what's the best. for their kids. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out over the next couple of weeks.
And think about this, it's not far away.
Yeah.
And think about this. Keep your eye on the various governors. What is turning out to be a national disgrace is Governor DeSantis in Florida.
Right.
You know, he follows his boss's rulings. There isn't an independent bone in the guy's body when it comes to what people should be doing. I think many of the Republicans are now saying masks are warranted, but only because they were shoved, you know, into their ears. I'm trying to get the right physical metaphor here.
I think we got it. So this is, I guess, Chris, you know, you just wonder then how schools respond to it, and especially because ultimately you have to tell the parents your kids are or are not coming back to school, and there are going to be situations where, well, there are going to be situations that's going to be the case. You're going to really tick off everybody.
Yeah, I mean, the governors are going to find themselves in a pretty tricky spot, right? Because on the one hand, they're going to be under a lot of pressure from the president and from a lot of business leaders to reopen everything. On the other hand, you know, you can see parents reacting with, you know, justifiable hostility if they feel that their kids are being put into an unsafe situation.
We
only have about 10 seconds, but go ahead.
Well, it's just like the Liberate movement that he tried to start to get all the governments to reopen. We had all the protests, and look how that's backfired, and everybody regrets ever even listening to him. The same thing is going to happen here. You're going to have Liberate schools, and it's going to backfire.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. The other part of this story that we were talking about just before the break had to do with colleges, not just K through 12 schools, but also colleges. And I mentioned the visas and what the White House is looking to do. What was announced on Monday was seen as an effort to pressure universities into reopening their gates and abandoning the cautious approaches that many have announced would adopt to reduce COVID-19 transmission. The effect may be to dramatically reduce the number of international students enrolling in the fall. Together with delays in processing visas as a result of the pandemic, immigrant advocates say the new rules, which must still be finalized this month, might discourage many overseas students from attending American universities where they often pay full tuition. So, Alan, this one has a little bit more of a solid, unlike the grade schools, this one really does have a seen impact.
Well, we know that. First of all, it meets his agenda of villainizing the others who come from other places. That's part of the ultimate strategy. You go to your base, you say, those people are coming in. We don't want those people here. You build a wall to keep those people out. You now say, okay, you're over here on some kind of visa, but we'll make sure that you can't meet the demands. We're going to make them so difficult, with all of the colleges and universities not yet reopened, we're going to tell you have to go to one that is open. So if you're in New York City, you can't find one, how are you going to do that? It really is so Trumpian and so expected.
Judy?
And it's also important to note how important the revenue is from these foreign students are to even small local community colleges like Fulton Montgomery Community College here in the Capital Region, or or RPI. And that revenue helps the college survive to serve American students. The other thing that they bring to the campuses are perspectives from other parts of the world. I always find it interesting in fall when the students return to RPI, you go downtown to a pub or you used to go downtown to a pub or a restaurant, and you would hear all sorts of different languages, and it was great to hear, and it's a great contribution to this country. The fact that the administration has announced this with absolutely no rationale, there's no real reason for doing it other than to keep the others out, it makes it even more absurd.
Chris?
Well, it's about forcing the colleges to open, right, because they need that revenue. So
they're hoping that sorry, I got distracted. My dog is deciding to jump at the car that I'm sitting in. I have no idea why she's doing that. Sure, you want one of these, Joe?
Yeah, I have that to look forward to. Excellent.
Yeah, but anyways, you know, it's about forcing the colleges to reopen, and you know, the broader context is that, as kind of Judy alluded to, a lot of schools are in a kind of deep financial trouble already, and the virus is obviously a terrible situation for them. You know, you talk about international students, but there are also a lot of American students who are not really thrilled at the idea of paying full tuition for online classes, or paying full tuition and then not getting the full
right.
college experience. So there's a lot of issues coming up in higher education this fall for sure.
And they're also,
you know, Joe, I teach at two universities that have large international student populations. Just about every class I teach has several international students in it.
You're at New Paltz and RPI, correct?
RPI, you're right. Yes. You know, the higher education is a huge employer in the country. So there's nothing about this that makes any sense from the perspective of a president that's serious about actually trying to unite the country and to create jobs in the country and to help the economy. This is damaging the economy, because if we don't get the revenue from these students, it does put jobs in jeopardy. It might even put my job in jeopardy for all I know. But it's going to have a very negative impact on the economy, not to mention just the negative impact on the overall racist message behind it. It just continues to create dysfunction and lower morale in this country. And it's very harmful, and it continues to just boggle my mind at how this president continues to avoid every single opportunity he has to bring the country together, to work as a leader, to try to put details and funding and direction behind these programs. But he just continues to double down on his racist message, and he's losing. He's losing badly. Let's not forget, he's losing badly.
Let's remember, I think this is very important, let's remember that from the very beginning he proclaimed that he likes the undereducated, by contrast with the educated. The educated folks in this country are being very careful about supporting him, I think. And that's not to say some don't, but, you know, for the most part, this is not his crowd. And so he's very worried about that, and he is playing to that, and he doesn't give a damn whether the colleges or universities go under, not a whit.
Mm.
But, you know, let's not forget that colleges and universities, yes, they employ college professors, but they also employ hundreds of thousands of people that clean the buildings, that work as staff, it is a place that employs large quantities of people in every single state. Some states, it's the largest employer. And, you know, not everyone there has a college degree. Many people there probably just have a high school degree, and that's great. I mean, it is a melting pot of individual people from all over the country with all different kinds of skill sets that it just offers a wide variety of employment opportunities, and to just shut it down makes no economic sense.
Well, all good points, except that this is a guy who deals with symbols. Keep the others out one way or another. He doesn't care about the poor people who are working in a university who are going to be affected by this. No, on the other hand, he is very concerned about doing what he can to objectify them and to give them a bad name. It's that simple.
We have a couple of letters on this. Russ says, you cannot open schools without spreading the virus. The best preventative measures would only limit transmission to a couple of people a day rather than several people per day. Testing 40 million children is also problematic. We will just have to accept a school year interrupted repeatedly with quarantine lockdowns.
No. Yeah, I'm not sure that that's true, actually. I mean, most of the European countries have reopened their schools, and they haven't seen big spreads of the virus within school communities.
But they don't
so
have the number
to do.
But they don't have the numbers.
Right,
I
understand. I understand that the context is different. But it isn't automatically that if you reopen schools, you're going to get a big spread. There are ways to do it where you won't.
Nicole's
right. It's a different situation in Arizona or Florida or someplace where, you know, it's spreading rapidly than it is in Denmark or, you know, Norway.
Nicole makes a similar point. FYI, all students in France were back in school and will be back in September. They all have to wear masks, even when France's curve is way down. And yes, will that be part of it? A panelist said, thankfully, Betsy DeVos doesn't have control over ... Yes, schools are under local control, but visas are under ICE, immigration control and enforcement control, federal control. Please speak to that, which I think we just did. And Bill says, my 13-year-old son attends a special needs school in Millbrook, and they are resuming the summer program this Monday. This doesn't get a lot of press coverage. Classroom sizes are cut in half, and they have a long list of health protocols and procedures in place. I wonder if the broader school systems can study what these special needs schools are doing.
Well, you know, Joe, every school district is deep into the data and the research to try to figure out what's right for their particular district based on how the virus is doing in that particular area. So I think what you're going to see is every district around the country, whether it's K through 12 or at the university level, is going to be doing something that's slightly different because their particular geographic location is going to require that. There is no one size fits all for this.
But they're also worrying, are they not? Are also worrying about getting sued. You know, somebody gets the disease, brings it home, and somebody is going to say to a school district, right, that you acted irresponsibly. Mm. And as a result, you know, we're going to have to – there are two things about being sued. One, maybe the people who are doing the suing won't collect, but they sure as hell will make you spend a lot of money defending yourself.
We got another letter from Pete who said, as a person that works directly – closely in proximity wise and in instruction with students with special needs, I do not feel safe in going back on campus. Not only am I over 50, but I also am responsible for my aging mother, whose quality of life depends on my survival, let alone her own health. Trump's international student obstacles can only be interpreted as the latest example of racism that he now embraces publicly. Trump, in trying to control education, shows an area that, again, he has not experienced success in, and possible not even firsthand at that.
Well, that's not fair. He did go and get somebody to take the test for him. So
allegedly, yes. Yeah. Well, we should say that, I guess.
Yeah, we say allegedly.
You know, one factor in this that kind of speaks to what Terry was saying about how this should be local decisions is air conditioning. You know, there's a lot of concern that air conditioning is one of the ways that that the virus is spread, or air. You know, these buildings.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, in places like Texas this time of year where kids go to school, I believe in late August, it is very hot. You know, it might make a lot of sense for them to delay the school year a few months just so they're not putting in, so they can open the windows and they can have, you know, a different environment, you know, or to move classes outside that do creative things like that. And that's why it really does need to be a decision that's made kind of locally and kind of a one size from the top fits all solution, you know, just won't work.
Another part of this is that schools that have released tentative plans and plans for discussion have an opt-in, opt-out. So your child can go if you feel comfortable with that, or does not have to go every day if that is what you and the student are more comfortable doing. I wonder how much that will be done across the board.
Well, at least see how that works.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Judy?
You're already seeing that on social media where people are already saying, I'm not going to let my child go back to school no matter what. It's almost like they can't force me to do this. They can't force me to wear a mask, and they can't force me to send my child to school. It's kind of at odds with each other. I'm thinking in New York State, we might see a regional approach to how the schools are reopened. Upstate, where the incidence of the virus is a lot less, even though it's low all over the state, I think there might be a better willingness to open the schools rather than in the schools which are far more crowded down in the city in Long Island area. That's just a guess, but I'm thinking that might be the way New York State decides to go.
But just
you know,
go ahead, Alan.
I'm sorry. I know this deviates a little bit from the tenor of the discussion, the main points here, But Chris wrote a great column about Miss Stefanik, Congresswoman Stefanik, and it really was terrific. You know, it's very interesting for me as a political scientist now to watch what the various governors and congresspeople do, either blindly or thinkingly, in terms of following the nonsense that we're seeing from Trump. And Chris, I know you're going to keep an eye on that one as it relates to this very discussion. I mean, where is she going to be?
Yeah, I mean, she has tied herself so closely to Trump at this point that I don't think there's any going back. But I think that you are seeing Republicans more and more kind of, you know, trying to distance themselves.
Sure.
Because they see what's going to happen if they don't. I mean, the numbers are kind of remarkable. I know we're going to talk about some of the fundraising numbers later, but, you know, the polling is just for Biden is just kind of any Republican has to look at that and see, you know, that there's a not just a blue wave coming, but some sort of blue tsunami, you know. Am I saying that right? Yeah. Tsunami?
Tsunami.
Tsunami.
Tsunami. Yes.
Yeah.
Silent T.
More than two.
So it was Stefanik's, as you point out, Chris, it was her role in Trump's defense team that made her a star of sorts. But how is it playing at home? How do you think it'll play in the district?
You know, that's a pretty safely that's one of the things that was confusing about her decision to kind of tie herself so closely to Trump is that she didn't seem to ever be in any danger. I mean, it's a safely red district. It is a Trumpy district. He is popular there, or at least he has been. But she would have won no matter what, you know. So it was a strange decision to tie herself so closely, especially since she hadn't done that, you know, in 2018 and 2016, and she had won. You know,
but she guessed wrong.
Kind of famously.
She may want more than being a congresswoman. She may want to be vice president of the United States at some point. She may want to be a United States senator. Who knows? But ambition will do that to people, right? So you're right.
And, you know,
she would have gotten reelected.
That was kind of the point of the column is that, she had made a bad bet because if, you know, yeah, she did increase her national prominence and she did increase her fundraising quite a bit. But if Trump goes down to a massive defeat, which seems increasingly likely, you know, I think that there will be a reckoning within the Republican Party. And a lot of the people who are more closely tied to the president, you know, may carry his stink for a few years or forever.
She may have really
permanently harmed her reputation.
We're really late for a break, so let's...
Well, I just want to say that Graham has changed his mind, so I don't know why it's too late for her, Chris.
In
certain cases, he certainly has objected to the way in which to certain political positions on the part of the president.
Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Chris Churchill, Terry Gibson, and Judy Patrick. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We have a number of them, so let me go right to them. James says, anyone with eyes and a brain by now can readily see that the man with a hollow, dark, unhappy center who sees his lifetime of mean-spirited vitriol coming back on him like the backwash of a tsunami. There you go, Chris. will go back to school and all other forms of the distraction shell game because he knows he is going down. Keep up the great discourse, says James. Richard says, I'm a high school teacher in Western Massachusetts. There are many solutions for having our students and school community return in the fall. The school officials and teachers are well aware of the important health protocols to keep the entire community safe. Our best made plans may or may not work. We all need to demand better testing. Why can't each person entering a school be tested once a week? Our federal government needs to help with this type of plan, which goes to what we were talking earlier about of this edict coming without any money attached to it or any real guidance as to how you do it. But isn't there a scenario, panelists, isn't there a scenario, a very real possible scenario where the whatever town school, Smithville School, decides that they're going to go back and 2 days in, four teachers are test positive for the coronavirus. And then what do you do? Aren't we right back to where we are at this moment?
What do you think we do, Joe?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it just seems to me that if you, I agree with the testing idea, but I just, it does seem if you go back to school and then you test, which you should do regardless, but are we going to be right back where we are right now when those tests come back positive? How long will that, we're seeing this in restaurants now, how long will that be, will be an issue? Chris, do you
have any?
Well, go ahead, Terry. No, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I was just going to say it's going to be an issue until we have a federal government with a leader that can put in place a funding program for adequate testing and also for contact tracing. So, yeah, it will just be a continual circle until we have a program in place federally that allows us to deal with these issues on a one-on-one basis and take the proper procedures.
Chris?
I mean, you raise a good point, Joe. It's and you know, imagine that from a parent's point of view. You know, the one thing I think parents want is some sort of plan. You know, if they send the kids to school, if they make arrangements for the kids to go to school, and then the kids are back at home 4 days later because there's been an outbreak. I mean, that's obviously very difficult from a parent point of view. But I don't know how you guard against that. I mean, there are going to be scenarios like that. I don't know. It's a tricky thing.
Well, if we had what some of these other countries have been doing, which is if we had a testing operation where people could easily get tested, quickly get tested on a daily basis outside of their employment location or outside of the schools, and also we had a contact tracing program in place, we would be mitigating down to a very small minimum the risk of people even coming to school with the virus. But since we're not there, mm-hmm. we leave ourselves open right. to this scenario, and it is very dangerous.
Judy?
Yeah, I would be a lot more comfortable with all of this going back to school if everybody was in the same place as New York State. You have to remember that for a lot of parents, the go-to backup babysitting source is a grandparent. And in this scenario, you don't want children potentially who are infected with this virus to be hanging out with grandparents. And so that wipes that option off the table, which makes it all doubly hard. It's a terrible situation, and it could have been so much, it could have been handled so much better. And you know, we're wringing our hands at the, you know, what are we going to do? But I think there are things we can do. I'm hopeful that we can get, you know, education back on track. We just need some leadership here.
Joe, I just want to say one more thing on this issue, because what this is bringing out is something that schools have been dealing with for a long time, and especially K-12, and that long ago their priority of teaching was severely decreased because they have become the healthcare provider. They've become the mental health provider. All the things that we should have a healthcare system doing outside of school are not being done, and schools are being asked to do it. Until we fix that part of this problem, it's going to be difficult to expect that we can somehow implement a nationwide school system where we don't have to worry about the virus.
Well, you're right, but now what do you do now? I mean, you know, if we could only fix it all. But right now we're faced with a dilemma. Which way to go? What do you think?
Well, I think that we have got to get some federal leadership. The schools do not have the funding.
You're not going to get it. You're not going to get federal.
There isn't a school. There's not a school. There is not a school in this country.
You
right
are
now
not
going to
get.
They need.
You're not going to get federal leadership. You're Andrew Cuomo. You're sitting up there. You're governor of the state of New York, and you have to make a decision. What's your decision?
Well, then you're going to do the safest possible thing you can do, which is you're going to try to mitigate the damage. You're going to keep people at home. You're going to keep people online. You're going to decrease exposure as much as you can, and it's not going to be what people want. People are not going to be happy with this. And
they're not
going to
be happy either way, right? Well, I mean, you send the kids to school, there'll be a lot of people saying you're causing the infection rate to rise. You don't send them to school, and the businesses can't reopen. You hold them responsible for that. Tough time
to
be a politician.
Unfortunately, without federal leadership and without federal funding, there really isn't a happy choice right now.
Well, forget it. You're not getting federal leadership. End of discussion.
Well, I know, but you still have to deal with the situation.
Well,
we do have
Congress, right? We do have Congress. They do have power up the purse, and they should be up there right now trying to figure out how to fund the school system across the country. And instead, they're on a break right now.
as I've said so many times, should schmud. They're not. They're not doing it. You got a United States Senate, which is going to blindly follow this guy right down the rat hole. And I'm just asking you, because let's face it, let's keep it real. What do you do right now?
So do you think they shouldn't open, Alan?
Yes, I think they shouldn't open, and I think they should open. So I'm in the same dilemma that everybody else is. But if it means saving lives, and if we go into it and we open them up and it turns out that you've got the increase in the virus and the pandemic, you're going to have to keep them home. You're going to have to. I don't think there's any question about that. Now, you're Andrew Cuomo. You're sitting there. You got your head in your hands. What do?
It's going to look a lot like what we had when school was when everybody was home in the fall. It's going to inevitably come back to look like that at some point if we don't have some type of testing or contact tracing program in place. There's just no way to avoid it because parents do not want their children exposed to that. But I do think that New York State and many states and many governors that are responsible are going to do the best they can to put in place a system that does allow schools to open and to some sense of normalcy. But it won't be anything that we've recognized as normal in the past.
Well, in all due respect to you, because I do respect you a great deal, that I would call BS on that. I mean, you know. You have to make a decision.
How so? Well, I mean, the governor makes a decision, but you're going to have. I mean, but we talked about it. I mean, if then the scenario comes where you have the teachers, then you are back where you were before, right? I mean, there's.
Look, to some degree, Joe, this whole scenario is going to be affected by what happens, right? You send the kids back to school, it reopens. You send them back home. You have no choice. From a political point of view, it's awful. But in terms of the reality of the situation, as we always say, the answer is the virus is going to be leading us.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's probably the best answer to this whole thing. The virus has led us. It's going to continue to lead us. And at the end of the day, it's not going to really matter what Donald Trump says, because the virus ultimately always wins.
We have a ton of letters. I want to get to those. Let's go to a news break. When we come back, we will get to them and much, much more right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Chris Churchill, Terry Gibson, and Judy Patrick. We welcome your letters. We have a lot to get to, so let's go through the stack here, and then we'll move on to other topics. Paul says, Trump is asking parents to choose between their children or his presidency. Politically, I can't see this as a winning strategy. Is he trying to lose? Who's advising this fool? Biden wins 62% to 38%. We'll see about that, I guess. Of course, we will. Doug says, regardless of the lower mortality among children, some children will come from families who have contracted COVID, will spread it to other children who will then bring it back to their parents as schools are segregated by community. It will affect poorer communities the worst. It will accelerate the spread of the virus and turn some of those children into orphans. Peter says, as a retired teacher and principal, I caution people about rushing to open schools in order to provide full-time daycare for their children. Schools are not, and in my opinion, never were intended to be daycare centers. Primary and secondary schools are complex organizations with many moving parts. You can't simply send kids back hoping that all will be well. We need to rethink what we expect from our public schools. I challenge any politician to become the principal of an inner-city school for 1 month. Jeff says, thank you for discussing this Trump policy. I think there is potential disaster on two fronts in many schools. Most of the substitute teachers and a large percentage of the bus drivers are the age of risk who are working to supplement their retirement, and many are not coming back. Secondly, many small liberal arts colleges are very dependent on foreign students to help supplement their income, and this lifeline is being destroyed by Trump policies, and many of these schools could fold as a result.
You know, Joe, on the international student issue, too, what to keep in mind is it really is an economic issue. It doesn't make any sense. I mean, other countries would love to have these international students. We compete with other countries for international students. So if we tell a student they can't come to school here, then Canada or Mexico or any other country says, hey, we'll let you come here. It's a competitive situation, and we're just losing economic revenue. It just makes no sense.
Kathleen writes and says, Trump wants it both ways, relinquishing all responsibility and citing federalism. He left states to fend for themselves when the pandemic began. Now he wants to dictate a national policy regardless of local conditions. David says it is impossible to put together a distance learning program that is meaningful. We can kid ourselves. We can let the media giants and technology salespeople tell us we can move forward. But the reality is schools must open. We can't have degrees awarded from a distance. There is no way, there is no way we can structure programs that are adequate in such a short time frame. Much more will be lost if schools are not functioning. Sorry, please don't politicize this issue. Schools must open. Well, there's a question. Who wants it?
Well,
how do you not politicize it?
Well, I mean, the writer just discussed distance learning, which I have become immersed in the last since I guess the virus hit, and I'm deeply immersed in now. I would take issue with something that was said there. I do think that we have learned that it is possible to provide some distance learning for some courses in a relatively effective way. That it isn't useless. I mean, it can work. But there are certainly courses and classes where it is very difficult, and I don't think there's an educator in the country that wouldn't prefer to be in the classroom right now doing what we used to do. But there are safety issues here that we can't ignore.
So, Alan, how do you keep politics out of it? Is that
well, as you know, to the point of repeating myself many, many times. Pardon me. If politics is the authoritative allocation of scarce resources, then the answer is every time you make a decision like this, you're in politics. Now, if what you mean by that is party politics, Democrats versus Republicans, then you got an interesting development here. And it's been raised by this excellent panel a number of times this morning, which is what in the heck does Trump think he's doing here? He keeps sinking lower and lower in the polls because he makes personal decisions that he thinks are going to affect his ability to get reelected. He becomes more of a racist. He becomes somebody who believes that we're going to send your kids to school even though it may harm them and they may bring the virus back home. No matter what he does, he's in a very bad spot right now. So is it political? Of course it's political. Has he made it political? You bet he has. When he refuses to wear a mask and he kills all those people in America, he's making it political. The very judgment not to wear a mask is politics, right?
And you know, in that Absolutely. Meeting, yeah. Alan's point, in that meeting they had yesterday where he demanded that schools open, there was a room full of people not wearing masks. It's unbelievable.
Chris?
Yeah, I mean, we've politicized wearing masks, so I don't see how the school issue will end up not being politicized. I mean, that's be wonderful if it weren't, but it just doesn't seem realistic. And to go to the kind of the broader point about Trump, it is almost, if you thought this guy wants to lose, this guy's trying to lose, he would be doing a lot of the same things that he's doing now. You know, he seems to want to run to be the governor of, and this is going to sound condescending, but you know, he seems to want to be the governor of Alabama. He keeps doubling down on winning the states where he's already winning, right?
Right.
I mean, the Confederate flag thing, the Bubba Watson thing, all these things that just, he's already got those states. What he needs is, you know, suburban Philadelphia and suburban Denver. And almost everything he's doing is kind of repelling those parts of the country. And the school thing falls right into that. I mean, suburban moms in Philly or Boston or, you know, any swing state you can name are not going to be thrilled with the idea of the president just dictating that their kids go to school no matter what.
So maybe Mary Trump is right. In other words, that is her last name.
Yes.
Right? She uses
yep.
Trump.
Yep, yep.
Maybe Mary Trump is right. Maybe his self-image is so bad, so poisonous, that he keeps digging himself, somebody said 3-year-old before, but I think more like a 2-year-old, into a deeper and deeper hole, thinking that it is because his methodology was successful the first time around, that it'll be successful again if he just sticks to it. So he hasn't got the ability to say, okay, there are some things I could do that would change the situation. For example, right. I could walk out there with a mask. I could say, you know, folks, maybe I didn't have it right, but every American ought to be wearing a mask and we'll save lots of lives. He'd get a lot of people who said, oh, you know, you got to give them that.
You know, a different president in his situation could have really used the coronavirus as an opportunity. You know, when this thing hit our shores, you know, he was at 40% popularity or 42%, whatever it's been. And he could have said to himself, listen, this is a great chance to show people how I can lead, how I can unify, how I can help the nation through a crisis. And he could have come out of this potentially in a much more popular place and in a much stronger place going into the November election. Instead, he kind of did the opposite, where the message was conflicted. He divided everybody. It's confounding. I mean, if I were a Republican running with my name under his name on the ballot, I would just be banging my head against the wall every day watching what he's doing.
But, Chris, why? The question for you and for every psychologist and for everybody who's looking at this is, if it's so clear to you and it's so clear to me that he is killing himself, why is he doing that? Well, we're going to get letters from people who are just wrong, that he doesn't want to win and he wants to get out of it. That's just wrong. So why, what in his character makes him do this? Now, we all went to school with miscreants, right? You mm-hmm. you remember them, don't you, Chris?
Yeah.
You know, some guy in your class who just took every opportunity to alienate everybody. And that's what this guy is. And that's why the Mary Trump book is probably right.
But it's interesting, that whole idea of not wanting, and you've talked about this, Alan, and I think Chris is making this point, but it's just of making no attempt to broaden your base at all. I mean, not anything. I mean, you're solidifying a base that's there, is solid, it is proven to be solid, and yet you're doing so
it's
many.
It's not enough. It's not enough.
But there's nothing. Right. There's nothing in his past history that would indicate that he has the skill set or the knowledge, the know-how, or even the interest in doing that.
I mean, right.
He is operating now as he has operated. Since, according to Mary Trump, since he was 3 years old. I mean,
right.
That's exactly right.
That's when character is set. Freud said so.
I mean, Freud said so. He's doing this because this is what he knows how to do. This is all he knows how to do. It's how he survives. It's how he's always survived.
Will he survive this?
Yeah. I don't know.
He also won.
I mean, strategically.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Strategically, you could make a case that You can win a base election in this country. I mean, he kind of did it in 2016, and they have spent the last 4 years trying to register people who are in the kind of the core Trump demographics. There is a case to be made for, you know, winning that way. It's harder, though, than it is to try to appeal to the middle. I mean, that's a more sound way to win. And the problem that Trump has run into is that he's running against Joe Biden, who – it's hard to make Joe Biden scary, even to Republicans.
That's right. He's a moderate.
So I think, So the kind of just throwing red meat to your base, it's just not going to work the same way as it might if there had been a different Democratic candidate.
Well, he and Dick Nixon have something in common. They're both counting on the fact that there is a moral majority who won't tell their mother or their pollster what they really are thinking, that they're racist, that they're this, that they're that. That's what he's counting on. He's counting on the fact that he could make that argument to so many Americans. Yeah, I'm sorry, Chris. Go ahead.
Okay, but he didn't follow the Dick Nixon, the Richard Nixon model, though, did he? I mean, Nixon won in 1968 with 43-44% of the vote. And did a lot in the next 4 years to kind of make himself more appealing to the middle, including doing moderate things like launching the EPA and then won in 72 in a huge landslide. I mean, that could have been the model that Trump followed. Instead, he just kept feeding the base and made no attempt to move toward the middle like Nixon did.
You know, there's speculation that he wants to expand that base, that there's an untapped slice of that base that's been hiding in the woodwork, and by repeatedly appealing to them, they're going to crawl out of the woodwork this November and puff him up enough to give him the votes he needs in those swing states. That base is bigger than people really believe. That Trump thinks there's more there than everybody thinks.
I just want to mention
there is truth to that.
Go ahead, Chris.
There is truth to that, and they use the rallies to register those people. I mean, there are millions of people who would be in the kind of the core Trump demographic who haven't been voters or who didn't vote in 2016.
Which is why
if they didn't vote in 2016, what's going to bring them out now?
Well, which is why the Democrats have to watch very carefully how they play this, because if they are seen by that group as being radicals or radicalizing the political system, some of those people will come out and vote. It makes me nervous every time I see the Democrats do something really stupid.
We have a couple. Just a couple of things here. One is that one breaking story is that universities are both Harvard and MIT are suing the president in federal court. They just filed their suit seeking to block the directive that would strip foreign college students of their visas if their coursework was entirely online. The universities argue that the policy announced on Monday was politically motivated and would throw their higher education into chaos. It was widely seen as an effort by the White House to pressure universities into reopening and abandoning the cautious approaches that may have announced they would adopt to reduce COVID-19 transmission. Meanwhile, there is the Supreme Court that has come out and said that the hold on. My screen just went dead here. One second.
And while you're thinking about that, Joe, let's just remember that into this whole mix comes John Roberts, who we now know had an incident, fell on the floor.
Correct.
Like I did not that long ago, ended up with blood all over him, and it turns out there were other things in his medical history. And without Roberts on this court, there's going to be a tremendous potential for, I think, real damage.
We also hear this morning from the Supreme Court at issue was the Trump administration's decision to expand the types of organizations that could opt out of providing cost-free access to contraceptive care and the extent to which the government should create exemptions for religious employers and others who assert moral objections. The Supreme Court has ruled, says employers may opt out of Affordable Care Act's birth control mandate over religious and moral objections. And there will be more coming out on that. I don't know what the vote is, and I don't know what the breakdown is, so we'll wait for more information on
I'm going to bet it's 5-4.
No, it's 7-2 with Ginsburg and Sotomayor in dissent.
Wow.
All right. Well, so those are two breaking stories that we will have more on. Also, just a programming note, we also have the governor coming up at 11:30 this morning speaking, giving his briefing and an announcement coming up at 11:30. So we'll be airing that live as soon as it becomes available. All right. Meanwhile, more letters, and we'll then move on. Greg says, the panel wants it both ways. Allow foreign students in so they can go to school, but keep our kids home. I don't get it.
And what does Greg want us to do?
It doesn't say here, but I'll forward it to you, and you can ask him.
Well, I don't know. I don't know that.
No, thank you.
I don't know that that's what any of us said. I think the issue here is that currently, until this ridiculous directive came out, online international students were being treated the same as all other students. If all students were being asked to take online classes, they were a part of it. The problem here is that all of a sudden the administration is saying, no, we need to treat international students separately, and they must be on campus. So that's where the problem is.
Very well said. Very well said.
All right, we go to Deborah, who says, Alan, he does want to lose. Then he'll start a competitor to Fox News, only 1,000 times darker and more racist. John says, we have a national television system. Why not dedicate a dozen channels, call them grades 1 through 12, and have a national teach-in 5 days a week, 6 hours a day? The curriculum across the country is virtually the same anyway. Local teachers would support the effort by correcting tests and checking homework using the internet. Yes, there would be gaps, and this is no permanent substitute for in-school learning, but it's better than all the hand-wringing we have now, and most importantly, it would be safe for all.
Well, first of all, the curriculum across the country is not the same. The curriculum varies greatly from state to state, county to county. Just take how history is taught, for instance, and to look into that if you want to really drill down into that subject.
Remember Winky Dink and You? Do you remember that show?
No.
Do you remember that, Alan?
I must have missed that one.
This was
I'm blocking it out.
It was in the early 50s. It was Jack Barry, and you would put a little piece of...
How do you know about the 50s? You're not old enough to know about the 50s.
I read about them. Oh. And I've seen the show. But they put Jack Barry, the guy who was Joker's Wild, who was also involved in the big game show scandal. Anyway, he put this plastic screen over your television set, and it had crayons, and they'd say, oh, get Winky Winky Dink to school. And you could do something like that.
Wow. That is so interesting. You know, when Sylvia Ostro bought a television on the 13th floor, invited us up, she gave us a set of rules, and one of them was that you couldn't do anything to the television set, including throw your shoes. This is very specific. Throw your shoes at the television set.
Well, and that is why, sadly, Winky Dink went off the air, because so many kids were using crayons on the TV without the special plastic shield, you see.
Yeah, I see. Now I see. Yeah.
Yeah.
Joe, I'd love to weigh in on this Winky Dink issue, but I want to just say
I know
back to the original letter writer's comments about this television programming across the country for education. Let's not forget that every individual school district is controlled by local elected officials. People in their districts go to the polls every couple of years and elect who they want to represent them and who they want to control their school district. So we don't have a federal education program that's controlled by the federal government to the degree that something like that could be put in place. Individual school districts and individual state governments have the ultimate real control over our school districts. And that's why it's varied all over the country.
Let's go back to the letters. Remember the one-room schoolhouse? Asks Kathleen. Small cluster of children of various ages, some siblings and or neighbors, one teacher and teacher aide. Create pods in the school replicating that model. Teach for America could ramp up its recruitment and teaching to provide a battalion of young teachers.
Well, you know, Joe, this is interesting, this business of what we're going to do with education, because let's not forget, you know, my daughter is a college professor. Her husband is a teacher. My son has a PhD. Their kids are going to be fine. But, you know, one of the things that schools should be doing and are doing is become equalizers for people of different socioeconomic positions. So I think it's easy to say that, but I think it's important to remember what our schools do.
Absolutely.
And let's not forget that this is a short-term problem. This is not a forever problem that we need to address. This is something that let's hope that a vaccine will come around sometime in the winter and help us all make a lot better, more useful decisions about schools. So this is something we need to deal with for the next 6 to 9 months. And we need to take a breath about that.
Maybe.
But I'm optimistic that this is a short-term problem, and we don't need to remake, you know, schools for forever. There are a lot of things maybe we can improve as we innovate ways to teach children safely in the coming months. But this is just something we've got to get through. The politics of we must go send them back to school, that's a political statement. We don't absolutely have to send the children back to school yet. Keep in mind that this is not a forever problem.
You know what? There are going to be studies of this from the moment, as you hopefully are correct, there will be studies of what happened to this group of students, this cohort, as a result of not being in school. It'll be fascinating.
We have about a minute before we have to go over to a break, and just a reminder again that we are going to be going to the governor at 11:30 this morning. Why is no one making the connection between the air systems in schools and returning staff and kids into the buildings? The air system seems to be as important as wearing masks and social distancing. This from Edie. Will all schools retrofit their air systems? Will the federal government pay, since Trump is all gung-ho on getting back to school? If you think so, then you probably still believe that Mexico will pay for the wall. that is the point you brought up, Chris, I believe, earlier.
Yeah. I mean, that's why I said, you know, maybe delaying the school year a few months in some of the hotter states might make some sense, just so you can open the windows or move classes outside when the weather's okay.
And I mean, you know, the civil servants in New York State are making the same case. They're saying to Governor Cuomo, okay, you want retrofitted air conditioning in businesses. How about us? You know, we're working up there. Yeah. How about us? Are you going to do the same thing for those people who are working for the state who also have air conditioning in their business?
Some schools don't even have air conditioning. I mean, even the classes the one I teach at RPI. To. Even at RPI, yeah. Some of the rooms there, you know, the air conditioning is opening the window. That's the air conditioning because, you know, it's cool most of the year. So there are lots of places across the country that either have no real HVAC system, no AC system, or the one that they have in place is so old and ancient because they haven't received enough funding to replace it that it's just not practical. So this is a very complex issue.
We have to take a break. Guess what we're getting the most mail on? Winky Dink.
Winky Dink.
Yeah, that's what we're getting all the mail on.
It will always be so.
All right, we'll take a break. We'll read some Winky Dink letters and others when we come back right after this short break.
Winky Dink and you, Winky Dink and me, always have a lot of fun together. Winky Dink, and you, Winky Dink, and me, we are pals in fair or stormy weather. All the kids.
Oh, Mike Bowen does it again. Amazing. Bringing that up so fast. Thank you very, very much. Let's see. Real quick now, you tell me. I was trying to find a new hobby by watching The Joy of Painting, and now I can get the magic of white off my flat screen. Geesh. I was a major Winky Dink fan, says Alice. Not only did I color the wooden cabinet, I also colored the cloth speakers that surrounded the tiny TV screen. I survived. And we also got this. He said, my little sister wrote right on the TV, big trouble as we only had one set, said Elaine. And yes, that was the demise of Winky Dink. Let's go to two breaking stories. We have a pair of them. One is much related to what we have been talking about this morning in regards to schools. News from New York City. And the classroom attendance in September will be limited to only 1 to 3 days a week in an effort to continue to curb the outbreak, according to the mayor, announcing that the nation's largest district will not fully reopen in the fall. That announcement made just moments ago. After 4 months and 1.1 million New York City children were forced into online learning, Mayor de Blasio announced this morning that public school, just about 10 minutes ago, announced that public schools would still not fully reopen in September, saying that classroom attendance would instead be limited to only 1 to 3 days a week in an effort to continue to curb the outbreak. The mayor's release of his plan for the system, by far the nation's largest, capped weeks of intense debate among elected officials, educators, and public health experts over how to bring children back safely to 1,800 public schools.
So let's be listening real carefully, Joe, to Governor Cuomo, who is coming on, as you just have mentioned, at 11:30.
Yep.
As you know, he quite frequently disagrees with decisions that have been made by the mayor. And he quite frequently says, this is my job, not his. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there. But, you know, think about it. That means that your kid, if you need a kid in school and you're a parent or working parent, that means 2 or 3 days a week your kid gets taken care of and the other days, no. So that's fascinating. What do you think, Chris?
Yeah, I agree with you on the governor. It will be really interesting to see what he says about that. And I'm trying to figure out how exactly that makes, what the reasoning behind that is. I mean, if they're going to be there a few days, then why not have them there? I don't really know what good it does to go back and forth like that. But that does put parents in a really tough spot because they can't commit to going to work full time. They can't commit to making other arrangements. It's
Yeah, that's a really interesting. That's interesting news. I mean, if schools can't reopen in New York, I don't know what they're going to do in Texas and places where the virus is still really spreading pretty rapidly.
Well, it may be that what they're thinking is that different people will come on different dates. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I haven't read the story yet, so I don't know.
I guess that makes sense. You have emptier buildings, and you can distance people a little bit. You know, when I see the CDC guidelines, though, that say that, you know, children should wear masks, and they should stay 6 feet apart, and they should not, you know, they should put their backpacks in certain. I wonder how much experience any of these people have with children. I mean, they're not going to stay.
They don't know my grandchildren, right?
Or education. I mean, something else that has to be factored in is if you are trying to keep people socially distanced in a classroom, it means that you have limited classroom space. You can only use spaces that can accommodate quantities of people 6 feet apart. I mean, it immediately probably makes many of your classrooms unusable because they're not big enough to keep people 6 feet apart. So another reason for keeping people at home more often is to allow that spacing to happen. Possibly.
I mean, it sounds, to be honest, it sounds a little bit cruel. I mean, second and third graders are not meant to sit at a desk with 6 feet of space around them all day. They're meant to move around and to jostle with kids. And I just don't see how that's going to work. And part of me thinks if those are the conditions that are going to be mandatory, then maybe schools shouldn't go back because I just don't see how that's going to work, and I don't think it's fair to the kids necessarily.
But these are the guidelines that the federal government has put out, which again, you know, completely takes what Donald Trump is saying and makes it ridiculous because his demand to do this doesn't fit with the guidelines. If you want to keep people 6 feet apart, if you have a classroom that's 60 by 60 and you have 50 students in that classroom, you can't fit them all in there 6 feet apart. So you have to reduce the class size. So, staggering
days. Under the mayor's plan, 6 feet apart regardless, right?
Well, under the mayor's plan, there will be no more than a dozen people in a classroom at a time, including teachers and aides. And they say that typically a class size in New York City schools is about 30 kids. I think the idea, according to my grandson goes to a daycare, the kids are there, they're together, they're 5 years old, but they're the same kids, and there's probably seven or eight of them, and they are always together. So the idea is to limit that's their bubble. They have their class bubble. The point, mm-hmm. though, is where are they going to find the space for this? They're probably going to alternate kids. Some kids will go on Monday and Wednesdays, and some will go on Tuesdays and Thursdays.
I'm sure a lot
of school districts are talking about doing.
I'm sure that's what they're doing. It's what colleges are doing, too. It's why some campuses are only bringing back freshmen. Some are only bringing back sophomores. These buildings that we use to educate people in are not made for social distancing. They're actually made to cram as many people as possible into one space. So most K-12 buildings and colleges are finding many of their facilities just inadequate right now, and it really does limit the amount of people they can have on campus.
Under the mayor's plan, there will probably be no more than a dozen people in a classroom at a time, including teachers and aides, a stark change from a typical class size in New York City, which can hover around 30 kids. Educators widely consider online learning to be a poor substitute for the classroom, especially for children and those with special needs. The shift has also created enormous challenges for parents who have struggled helping their kids learn, even as they have to maintain jobs from home, or if they are essential workers, had to scramble for childcare, much like we discussed earlier in the program. Still, like New York City's many school districts around the country are planning on not fully reopening and instead will use a mix of in-person and remote learning indefinitely. All right. The other breaking news that I mentioned earlier is the Supreme Court decision. We have a little bit more information. The Supreme Court is siding with the Trump administration in its efforts to allow more employers to opt out of providing no-cost birth control to women as required by the Affordable Care Act. The High Court on Wednesday said 7-2 that the administration acted properly when it allowed more employers who cite a religious or moral objection to opt out of covering birth control. We hold today that the departments had the statutory authority to craft the exemption, as well as the contemporaneously issued moral exemption. We further hold that the rules promulgating these exemptions are free from procedural defects, that according to Justice Clarence Thomas, who wrote that.
Oh boy!
As a result,
oh, brother.
As a result, I mean, let me. Can I just go throw up like right now? I mean, just.
As a result of one more line, and then you can vomit in any way you wish. As a result of the Obama-era health laws, most employers must cover birth control as a preventative service at no charge to women in their insurance plans. Okay. Judy?
So one of the rationales for this decision from the administration was the idea that these women could get their alternate health care coverage through the health care marketplace, my understanding. It's just a bad, I mean, from a woman's perspective, this is a very bad decision. I respect religious institutions' desire not to violate what they believe are their morals, but it's just going to mean that fewer people are going to want to work for them. And I think that our government should have stepped forward and protected women's rights to the same kind of health coverage that men receive. And in this case, I think it's discriminatory.
I think Judy's absolutely right. We're living in a time right now where people are looking at companies and employers in a way they've never done so before. And it's just going to encourage employers, talented employees, to seek out alternative employment to a place that's more caring for their employees.
Well, it's important to remember the court wasn't deciding whether or not this was the right thing to do. The court was deciding whether the Trump administration had the legal authority to do it, right? And it sounds like you said it was 7-2, Joe, so it sounds like it was a pretty not unanimous exactly. Who were the dissenting judges? Do we know?
Sotomayor and Ginsburg, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, women.
You know, 7-2 is...
Yeah, the women. Right. The women.
Yeah.
All right.
But, you know, like elections matter. The Trump administration does have the right to change regulatory laws if people want it to be handled differently than, you know, vote for a different president.
Let's go to, let's see, we have about 2 minutes, so I'll just read some letters here. This is on Elise Stefanik on our discussion there. Jeff says she is hard to defeat in that district because Fort Drum is such a powerful force in that district. Gerrymandering, if New York State loses a rep, she could be it for the Democratic state senators, or the Democratic state senators could move Fort Drum out of that district. Alan, any thoughts on that?
Well, I think, first of all, what's happened before is going to happen this time. It'll probably be, well, no, I'm not sure. In the last time we did the gerrymanders came up, we had a Republican state Senate. They weren't going to go along. Now we have, pardon me, two houses of the state legislature are both Democratic and a Democratic governor. So it is possible that they'll do that, but it'll have to survive federal lookout. I mean, the whole point about that huge, humongous district is you shove every Republican into it you possibly can. That's the way they do the gerrymander, as we know. But I do think what'll happen here is that we will lose one. And let's remember that Stefanik's district was represented by a blue dog Democrat for years, who does, by the way, commentary on WAMC. And so it's not a district that is incapable of electing a Democrat under the right circumstances.
Right. And now part of that district was once overseen by Chris Gibson, too. So that's also interesting. All right. I think we're out of time. We are out of time. Yes.
Oh, no.
Yes, we are. But we will. We're going to hear from Congress.
I have more to say.
You have 12 seconds.
Joke.
Go ahead.
Since it's a joke. Okay, go ahead.
All right. We are. My thanks to Alan Chartok, Chris Churchill, Terry Gibson, Judy Patrick. Thank you all. Coming up next, we have the Congressional Corner. And then at 11:30 this morning, we'll be hearing from the governor of New York State, Andrew Cuomo. All that right after this.